این برنامه را چهار راه در دسترس شما قرار داده است.
Today with us we have Rodrigo Buenolassi. Rodrigo has done his PhD in Nijmegen, Radboud University, in the field of political geography. He particularly studied European identity seen through cartography. Hi, Rodrigo.
Well, hello, Ali. Yeah, that's...
Would you please introduce yourself briefly and then tell us what was your research about?
Yeah, so my name is Rodrigo Bueno Lacy or Lacy, it is the same, depending on where you are, I pronounce it differently. I am Mexican, I am from Mexico City, I studied political science and international relations in Mexico City, and then I came to the Netherlands 10 years ago to do a master's in human geography, and I stayed to do doctoral research in political geography, particularly in what you mentioned, you know, in the how a European identity is constructed through cartography. How can you see the construction of European identity through cartography throughout history, and how, depending on each historical context, European identity changes not only on maps but also in its meaning, in its deeper meaning, and how this is expressed both in maps and in other cultural artifacts in, I don't know, Europe, but also in countries that reflect the idea that Europe has of itself. Yeah. So in a way, is the study of images to understand political identity, in my very specific case, to understand the meaning of political identity in Europe.
So basically using maps as some sort of representation, right, of the human's understanding of the world.
Yeah, so that is the basis of my research. The basis of my research is semiotics. And semiotics is both a discipline and a methodology that understands the meaning of reality as constituted by a collection of signs. No, so reality is not one thing. No, reality is a collection of signs, and each sign is associated to a certain idea or object. No, and not only that, but also these signs are edited. So these signs are representations. A sign can be anything. A sign can be a language or a system, a numerical system. A sign can be, of course, a painting or a symbol or a gesture or an intonation, or what is called a phenotype, no? An arrangement of physical features together with the adornments that people put on themselves and the traditional features of a community, no? And then the construction of these signs give you an idea of reality, no? Yeah. So the idea is that reality is cognoscible, so it's knowable only through representations, and that is important because that means that you need to focus on the edition of these representations and the channels through which they are transmitted, no? Which means basically who makes them, how are they diffused, no? Right. And which is the audience and how this audience is perceiving these images and these representations to make an interpretation of the world.
But that's a great point, right? Because that's how we understand the world, right? Through these representations that we receive. And these representations are mediated. Mm-hmm. They are controlled, right? So, for instance, given a map, that's what you're focusing on, mm-hmm. to try to understand how this information is encapsulated and provided, or reframed and provided to the public, right? Mm-hmm. And to form basically the identity of the public, or the wish or the will of the public, right? Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that? For instance, what was your conclusions, your studies? How did you see it during mm-hmm. How did you see the current contemporary or the last mm-hmm. centuries maps of Europeans has affected the European identity?
Yeah, I mean, there are no. It is not the kind of science that you can come to very strict conclusions about, because of the very nature of the object of study. No, the object of study are images. What I have is an interpretation. You have what I do is iconology, that is also part of semiotics. No, that is the main method that I use. So I study what images mean in themselves, in this case a map, but also what it means in connection to the society in which it is anchored. No, to the society that produces it. So how this image reflects, for example, the interests of the authors. The authors are, of course, not only the map makers, but also the people that finance them. No? And more than the people that finance them, many times were, for example, in the Renaissance, merchants. The people that finance these merchants are many times stockholders, for example. No? That is the beginning, and that is related to the Dutch Empire and to imperial European imperialism in general. But in the case of the Dutch Empire, it is related to the emergence of finance. So you buy a stock in the West Indies company, and the profit they make by bringing pepper from the Moluccan Islands, no, or muscat nuts, or from the Moluccan Islands, or pepper from the south of India, or whatever spices, no, that are located in Southeast Asia, no. Once they arrive to Europe, they sell them to 10,000 times a profit. And then that profit, that promised profit, is what you get, no? As an investor from buying stock. So this is the beginning of finance, these kind of things. If you look at the beginning of, I don't know, contemporary European cartography, it is related to the imperial enterprises of the Dutch, of the Spanish, of the Portuguese. Maps were crucial, no?
Of course.
And not only were maps crucial, no, but also for navigation, but they were also crucial for identity.
Right.
No, and that is something that, for example, is very important when people talk about colonization. I think many people talk about European imperialism and European colonization as something that was done from an entity that is well bordered and that is homogeneous, that is called Europe, to the rest of the world. And when you study maps, for example, you're going to study many other artifacts, you realize that the colonization also happened within Europe, no?
Right.
So Europe is a creation of the Renaissance in the same way as the colonies, the European colonies in America or in Africa or in Indonesia or in Southeast Asia, no? Wherever, are, no? The construction of identities happened both in the colonies but also in the European continent, because the idea of Europe is an imperial idea. And it was an idea that emerged, for example, with the Habsburg dynasty in Spain. No, they were the big rulers of Europe. No, it was a dynasty that, as the legend had it, possessed so much of the world that the sun never set on their dominions,
right.
Because they had possessions in both Europe and America. No, and also the Philippines. No,
it's
everywhere.
Very saying. The Spanish, they still say that, right?
Yeah, the Spanish.
The British also said that afterwards.
Yeah, I think so. The British had an even more expanded empire. No, so it's European expansionism is the beginning of globalization, but also the beginning of the expansion of a very specific political technology. No, the state.
This is great. This is very interesting. So if I understand it correctly, right? So we as humans, we understand the world around us as representations, right?
Yeah.
These representations are modified and controlled by the sources of power, right? And we are looking at a specific region, Europe in this case, right? Mm-hmm. And looking at one of these representations, maps, right? And then now we come closer to the era of imperialism, right? Mm-hmm. And how these representations was controlled and modified by the imperialist power, right? For certain purposes, of course, right?
Yeah.
And I can see two angles, right? I mean, one angle is about the identity of the citizens of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
How did these representations affected them and why, right? And the other factor would be how these representations would affect the rest of the world.
Of course.
Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, well, it's all part of the same. You can see this on maps. So the idea, the construction of European identity is very representational. So it's very much based on representations. And this representation takes place in many artifacts, in books, in literature, in painting, no? I think the most conspicuous and the most elaborate and the most defining depictions that you see of Europeans take place on maps, no? You see on the Renaissance map, so you see the backgrounds, for example, or you see the margins that are adorned with representations of both European peoples and the colonized peoples. No? And this is something that you see, for example, in taxonomical treaties, like the taxonomical treaties of Carl Linnaeus, no? This Swedish scientist and taxonomist that created a universal system of scientific classification. No? And what you see is a transition of representation. in the beginning, when they conquer, for example, no, when they colonize the American continent, the first depictions that come to Europe are fantastic, no, in the sense of incredible stories of incredible beings.
Right.
For example, Jewish communities in Europe, when they heard that there were natives, no, distinct to any other native in Europe or the known world in the Americas, they thought they were the 11, I think. I don't know the exact number. I think it is the 11 lost tribes of Israel, of which the Bible talked about, no? And they said, these are our brothers, no? And people had different claims, depending, because there was nothing could explain that, no?
It's very exotic.
It is so exotic that there was no scripture or text in Europe or the Middle East or any of the peoples, no? That the Europeans had an interaction with that could explain who they were. Now, the Spaniards took, for example, translators that were known for speaking, no, dozens, at least a dozen or two dozens of European languages or world languages, but they could not understand what these people were talking, of course, no, because they had never been detected. So these people said, not to lose their pride, when asked what these natives were talking, they said, they just don't talk, no? They don't speak. They are animals. They emit sounds. No? And then this is interesting because it is in the confrontation of these two, I don't know, civilizations, if you want to call them that, you see how a hierarchy starts being established as a consequence of power. So in the first maps, no, if we restrict this to maps, in the first maps you see descriptions. You see images that have very little civilizational value associated to them. So you see the Brazilians, the Mexicas, the different Indian groups that they detected, no, and of which they had an account and which they decided to depict on the maps, you see them without any connotation of inferiority. They have exoticism is suggested in their image. They are naked or they are cooking weird stuff. No, they are cooking weird dishes that are, no, unknown, not known in Europe or in Spain or in the Netherlands or in whatever country where these maps were being made. And then you have the Europeans that are differently dressed, no? They eat different, they have other musical artifacts, they have other books, whatever. So in the beginning you see that it is this very innocent exchange of of difference, or this very innocent remark upon difference. You have to understand, no? The discovery of America was the closest thing you can have to people on Earth meeting Martians or meeting extraterrestrials, no? For both of them it was inconceivable that this existed, that this could happen, no? Because it was entirely different. There were not only entirely different cultures, but also there was not a common language in which they could communicate, no? which already makes all sorts of communication very, very different than anything that Europeans had experienced so far. No, there was always a translator. In this case, they meet a world that they don't know nothing about, and there is no translator. No, so what they start to do is represent this. No, novels. No, it's super exotic. Everybody talks about it. Scientists, conquistadores, explorers. Everybody, and they send books to Europe. No, of statistics, of demographics, of how people look, no, representations. With time, of course, the conquest of the Spaniards, the British, the French, no, all these different empires starts to add power to these images. The power that
exotic by itself is nothing harmful, right?
No, it's just different.
But then it attracts the interest of people in power to pursue a certain agenda, yep, that it might be diluted, right? So
I would say two things, no? That it is not only the interest of people in power. Of course, there are many people that are interested in representing these people as inferior, no? For example, the natives. But it's also a consequence of the development of power itself, no? So for the Europeans that conquered, for example, no, let's say the Mexica Empire or the Inca Empire. No? This is a country the size of nothing, no, Spain. The most, that back then in the 15th century was the most excluded place, one of the most excluded places in Europe from everything that was considered progressive, no? The Renaissance did not take place in Spain, no, at the same time that it took place in Italy or in Flanders. The It was, in many ways, one of the most medieval places in Europe, in the sense of, for example, religious fanaticism. When they discovered America, they had just expelled all the Muslims, no? They had just expelled all the Jews, which in European history, in Spanish history, is known as the Reconquista, that they celebrate as their biggest party of national independence. One of their parties, one of their celebrations of national pride and independence. We kicked the shit out of the Muslims, no? We kicked them out of this country, no? But it's this amounts to the biggest ethnic, not only the biggest, one of the most momentous, one of the most significant, and one of the most atrocious ethnic cleansings in the history of Europe. Not only because the entire Muslim and Jewish populations from Andalusia were expelled, but because they were expelled by religious fanatics that destroyed one of the richest civilizations in the Middle Ages, no? The civilization of Andalusia is where the ideas of, I don't know, the primitive idea of humanism as a conception of humanity, not as a group of different nations, but as a group in itself that shares a common ground, regardless of all the differences, no? The idea of human rights, the idea of universal rights, no? That everybody shares, all these humanist ideas. The idea of convivencia, which is basically we can have Jews, Muslims, Christians living together, no, with a hierarchy, of course, but without killing each other. We can live in peace, no? Which was an idea that, for example, the king did not exist in the kingdom of Castilla, no, in Castile, which was the one that eventually conquered the entire Spanish peninsula. And that is also the thing. The state, the development of the European state, and you can claim that the oldest European state is the Spanish state, no? Is the beginning of colonization. So the development of the state, the Spanish state, the French state, the Dutch state, uses the same ideology and the same technologies than that the colonization and imperialism that these very countries later apply in, for example, America or their African colonies. Yeah, so the state is a political technology that is based on a certain amount of tools, both material and ideological.
Right.
No? Material tools are, for example, the constant need to survey and to measure and to read space and people. No? Now, for this, they use simplistic models, simplistic spatial and mathematical models. And you see this, for example, in the way they develop cities, no? Or the way they develop forests, especially in Prussia in the 18th century. They erase forests and they plant trees in lines, no? So as to make rows and columns in order to be able to multiply them and know exactly how many trees there are in large extensions of forest so that they can manage the forest, no? They can say, okay, we can cut this amount of forest, sell the wood, the state can make all this money and without depleting the forest, no? Because so science becomes very important also, but a very specific science, no? In the case of the forest, no? Everything related to, forestry, the health of trees, no? How to cultivate them, how to prevent them from dying, not because of the knowledge in itself, but because the science is useful for the development of the state, no? And the same happens, although with very different technologies, but very similar, developing the colonies. The main one is cartography. Because you have kings and you have royal administrations in Spain and in Portugal that have dominions across the ocean, 10, 15,000 kilometers away, and they need to manage them without not only the natives revolting, but without the elites, no, the Spanish elites revolting, which is something that they feared.
Right.
You appoint a viceroy, no, lieutenant of the king in the colonies, together with an enormous amount of the Spanish or the Portuguese aristocracy. They get lands, they get titles, they get positions, they get wealth, and they get an enormous amount of power over the life or death of entire continents, no? And then how do you manage them, no? How do you prevent the thought of, the king is too far away. Maybe, instead of being taking the place of the king, I can be the king myself.
Which happened sometime in history as well. But
And
then what was the common approach to it?
Well, the cartography and statistics. No, so they started to develop and favor sciences, disciplines, and technologies that allow them to have the feeling or the illusion, no, that they could actually control territories that were very far away at a distance.
Yeah.
For this, maps were crucial. Maps told you what you needed to know if you were a king. And that's why you see in, for example, maps from the Renaissance, or the age of globalization, the age of European discovery, you know, European exploration of the world, you see that the first maps they have, the names are around the coasts. You know, is what matters to European empires
sure.
that didn't know anything about the territory except for the ports and the no the littorals, the delineated littorals of the continent where they were able to disembark or found cities. Many of the first cities, many of the capitals of Latin American countries are ports first founded by the Spaniards or some of the ancient, most ancient cities, no? Like Veracruz is one of the most, is the most ancient city, I think, in Mexico City. I mean, the most ancient Spanish city, because it was the first city that was founded by the conquistadores that came from Cuba, no? Mexico was the ancient capital of the Aztec Empire. So Sao Paulo, I think, no, it was Sao Paulo, Brasilia, I don't remember which one, was also the first port that, one of the first ports that the Portuguese settled, no? So in this way, their colonization starts to import into, in this case, no, let's talk about, for example, the case of America, it starts to import the very prejudices that Europeans have about Americans. So they start to construct a reality that is more in their heads about what they are than what they really are. No? And this reality is not only constructed as a matter of agency. It's not only that the kings or the aristocrats in Europe say, we are better than them. It's also a consequence of power. You conquer them, no?
Right.
You conquer them and all of them look different, no? And this is very racial. All the Indians look different, no? So it is very different than the conquest of a country in which people don't look that different, no? Or at least they are white, for example, no?
Maybe it's difficult also to conquer them, so it's not that easy to conquer them.
No, it's not that easy to conquer them, of course not.
Yeah.
But the power, what is important, what is crucial is that this power starts to create very, very visible and very obvious differences. The conquered dressed, no? In a poorer way.
Yeah.
Their professions are related to servitude. Because they are slaves, they are servants. They get up, no? The women get raped, the men get enslaved. And it's clear who has the power. But
right.
It's not only clear who has the power in terms of better dress, better food, less suffering, less abuse. It's also clear in, no, the outer skin, no. These people have very different physical features. They have a very different color of skin.
Right.
They have a language that is, you know, entirely unrelated to anything that we can associate to the place where the conquerors come from. They have divinities that also, you know, for which there is, you know, as far as the Europeans know, nothing relatable in their own cultures.
Mm.
So the power itself, and especially the interaction between the colonizer and the colonized, starts to create the natural idea of hierarchy. People start to assume, not only are we different, but we are also better. Our books are better. Our music is better. Because look at them. They are filthy. Look how they live. Look how what they know. No? And this you start to see in maps. No? For example, something that is very typical about Renaissance maps is the representation of the four continents in each one of the corners.
Yeah.
No? Europe is usually at the top and on the left. So it is already a position of prominence. No? Then to the top and right, you have Asia, now, which makes sense because Asia, since ancient times, also in cartography, was represented as the wealthiest place. Not only because Christianity was assumed to come from there, which was very important for the first map makers that were monks and basically the Catholic Church, but also because in Asia you had the greatest empires from which what was known as wealth and luxury came. The Persian Empire, the Mongol Empire, the Chinese Empire. No, Europe did not have anything equivalent until the Renaissance. The Roman Empire, for example, was never European, no, in any sense that can be considered modern, even though many Europeans can consider it as its past, no? For the Roman and Greek empires of antiquity, the Germans were as foreign and as barbaric, no, as the sub-Saharan Africans. What they considered to be a civilization that matched theirs in terms of wealth, luxury, and sophistication were, I don't know, Eastern empires, no, with which they had very little contact. Maybe the Persians, maybe the Chinese.
Right. Huh? But mainly trading with Chinese and sometimes fighting with the Persians, right?
I don't know. I don't know much. I'm not an expert in Roman history. But my only point is that, for example, in the Roman Empire, in Roman and Greek antiquity, you can see that the representations that we have today about Europeanness are representations that do not coincide with this past. No? Many people would assume immediately that Roman, Greco-Roman antiquity is, no, the cradle of European civilization today. Whereas if you had a time machine and went back then, no, and you told them, no, you gave them a map of Europe and told them, so this is Europe, first of all, they would never recognize it. Because this kind of cartography did not exist back then. I mean, most of Northern Europe, most of Scandinavia was discovered in the 15th century, the same as the American continent. They had no idea how it looked, no? Cartographically. For them, the Germans spoke a language that was not only incomprehensible, but was barbaric. Not only the language was barbaric, the entire set of costumes they had was barbaric so much that the Romans were used to enslave large groups of Goths and Germanic tribes, no? Which were children, since they were children, they used them as house slaves, sexual slaves, no? Cheap labor and exploitable humans, no? So the idea that these people would recognize the Europe of today, no? As European, makes no sense today. This is a representation, for example, that has life as a representation only, not as a historical reality.
So basically, is the correct conclusion if I said that I understood that you mean the current identity of the Europeans, the one that they understand, the representation that it resides with them, is coming mainly from the imperialistic Europe.
Well, I mean, in a
centuries on.
Yeah, in a nutshell, yeah, you could say that. For example, that is it is a bit more complex than that, but yeah, you could say that the modern idea of Europe we have comes from globalization,
right.
No, and the technologies that developed through globalization. One of the main technologies was cartography, statistics, navigation, all the military technologies that were useful for their conquest. Of course, trade and finance.
And it's a very specific period of time, right? In history, it's a period that Europeans have this imperialistic endeavor towards the entire universe. Right,
mm-hmm.
And also they start colonizing a lot of other countries, right?
Yeah.
What do you think these images, this understanding of the world, has affected a white European of today, right? Not the one who has immigrated and has seen a different background,
mm-hmm.
but the one who recognizes himself as a white European.
So I think what you asked is how can we see, for example, in cartographic artifacts, so in maps, the evolution of European identity and particularly the idea of whiteness in European identity since the exploration of the world, no? As a consequence of the clash between European imperialism and the people that they colonized. And this
the
is
the glory of white as well, huh? Not that it's white, but the white is glorious as well.
Yeah, of course.
Superior.
Yeah, so the idea of white superiority, no? And now for this is very, I think, this is a very complex question because of two things, no? First, you need to understand that the idea of whiteness develops very differently in different empires, no? Each empire should be conceived as a political technology that is different than the other. Spanish imperialism, Portuguese imperialism, French imperialism, British imperialism are different technologies. Not every European empire practices empire and colonization and conquest in the same way. The structures of power that they put in place, including their idea of white superiority or European superiority, is very specific. And this is related to the way in which the places that they conquered were conquered, no? So, for example, the Spaniards and the Portuguese sent lonely men. They sent ex-convicts, prisoners, people that did not want to be on a transatlantic trip. When they arrived, after months of a horrible trip, in which the sailors were attacked by all sorts of diseases, there was a great deal of suffering, death, malnutrition and other physical disgraces, they arrive to America, no? And it's a little bit of a relief, no? But not only a little bit of a relief, they are on the other side of the world, no? Enormous amounts of lonely men, no? So they created families, no? The amount of sexual interaction between colonizers and the Indians is enormous. This creates not only a different society, a different colonial society that is still radically different, no? The colonial societies and their heritage that you see now in Latin American countries are radically different from the colonial experiences of other peoples. So this is something, the level of what you call transculturation, the mix of people, genes, cultures, traditions, families, is enormous, and it's comprehensive, and it goes so deep that it creates entirely new cultures that are not fusions, but are the fusion of many different cultures, but they create something entirely different. No? And this you can see expressed in cuisine, in literature, etc., whatever. Now, the idea of whiteness is very much related to how successful this is. So the Spaniards, for example, if you compare them to the British, tried something very similar, to put whiteness at the top. Now, this is, no, the idea of whiteness as conceived by the Spaniards, no, which is a very different idea than whiteness as conceived by the British. They don't see themselves.
Can you explain?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, the kind of populations in the Iberian Peninsula are different, no, than the populations in the British Islands.
Yeah.
One could say, no, the Spaniards are not blonde, for example,
right.
No. The Spaniards had, the moment they colonized America, already 1,000 years of interaction with the Moors, which created also an entire mix, no, of peoples in Andalusia, and that is why you see a very smooth transition of, in terms of demographics, when you go from Spain and no Andalusia and then to Morocco. People just look similar, physically similar, no? Because of Spain has existed less without Moorish influence than with Moorish influence. No? The Moors were there for about 1,000 years since the 700 something, no? 11, I don't remember exactly, until the Reconquista in 1492, when they expelled the Muslims, and then 1494 they expelled the Jews. No. Now, this idea of whiteness, for example, in what now is Mexico and the Spanish colonies, is very much, was very much related to very detailed and specific racial categories. Spaniards born in Spain had access to the best positions of government, no, and trade, and whatever other social positions were the best. Then you had the second, the criollos. No, the criollos were Spanish families. No, sorry, were the children of Spanish families, but they were born in the colonies. So that made them a little bit less.
Mm.
Their parents were Spanish, but they were not peninsulares, no? They were not born in the Iberian Peninsula. They were born in the colonies, and that, already in the eyes of this racial classification, made them a little bit less desirable. Then you have the mestizos. The mestizos were the combination of the Indian and the Spaniard, no? And the same, you know, following this hierarchical racial system, you go all the way to, I don't know, the what they conceived as the most Stradivarian, the most exotic mixes. And they express this in something that is called retablos. A retablo is an enormous piece, usually of wood, that is divided in, I don't know, in a grid. It is segmented through a grid, and each of these spaces, each of these cartouches, no, these spaces, iconographic spaces in the grid, depicts a combination, no, two parents, no, the color, the race of each parent, and the child with the race of the child, and the name of the specific racial configuration. But it has more than this. It is not only the parents; it is also the background. It is also the dress. It is also the wealth and the sophistication, the art, the culture, and the intellect, no. So they start to construct, as a result of power, as a result of who is the vanquisher and who is the colonized, which is, of course, a vicissitude, an accident of history, So who is the colonizer and who is the colonized? This is an accident of history, you know? But they start to construct the differences, the consequences of this. So the colonized as poor and the colonizer as wealthier and better, not as the result of a historical accident, but as the result of nature, no? Because it is so pervasive. Everybody that looks like that is more or less poorer, no, malnourished. They don't get the best jobs. They don't dress. Their children, of course, inherit whatever traits are associated to poverty. No, now we know much all of this better today. How poverty is replicated from generation to generation if nothing is done, if there is no intervention from society or from the state. But back then, of course, no, there was no, not even an idea of race, no, not even an idea. So this difference, and that is also the thing, the sciences that we now associate to the racial studies that allowed, for example, the Nazis or the Americans or any other country that ever played with racial categories to create them, no? And which were established as a matter of academic tradition in what we know as scientific racism, that was a very well-established discipline in American and European universities throughout the 19th and 20th century, no? This did not exist. This formalization of racism does not exist. And that is crucial, no? That racism...
Racism had existed, right?
No, the racism...
In the time of slavery. Yeah. So slaves usually would come from a certain race, no?
No, but there were ideas. The ideas... That is very interesting. The idea of racism did not exist. There were always notions of difference, no? But the notions of difference were related to very different formal systems of knowledge. So, for example, for the ancient Greeks had the idea, a cartographic idea of the world, from which their idea of the peoples of the world derived. No? But their idea of the world as a matter of cartography was wrong. As consequence, no, their idea of racism was also wrong, no, of course, of the races, the civilizations, the nations of the world. Also, other medical knowledge was what we, in comparison to what we have today or what they had in the 15th century, very primitive. What the Greeks used was more logic, observation. They came to a hypothesis, but they did not have anything close to the scientific method or even the technological means for scientific corroboration, no? They thought everybody inhabiting the Mediterranean, which was very conveniently where they were the civilized people, the Greeks particularly. The Greeks and the people influenced by the Greeks, no? The Hellenic civilization. Then these were people that were cooked right because the semen, no? The seed of both the man and the woman that created people in the Mediterranean region was cooked at perfection because of the temperature. Now, this is entirely ethnocentric, no? But this kind of ethnocentrism is something that you find in every single civilization that has represented itself in comparison to others. Now, they thought that the Germanic people were very melancholic, a little bit prone to depression and being serious and having little passion because of the cold, the semen with which all these nations, they thought about nations, no? Were created was too cold, so the people were baked at the wrong temperature and therefore were not as virtuous as the Greeks in the temperate regions. The same with sub-Saharan Africans, they were overcooked. No? Now, but this is not racism in the way we understand it today, because there was not notion of genetics, there was not notion of medicine, and that is the thing. Racism is an entire system of thought. Racism is not saying the black are worse and the white are better, no? Racism is not even related to being white or being black. I mean, not essentially. Of course, there is a relation, but it is not. You of course can have black people, no, that belong to a population that is oppressed, that are white, that want to be white, that preserve the system of knowledge on which white superiority or white supremacy is based. This is something that you see in the US today, for example. This is something that all the black writers that have meant something for the civil rights movement or the emancipation of black people in the US have always remarked. This is something that Malcolm X and James Baldwin always stressed, for example, that whiteness is not, when they talk about whiteness in a racial context, you're not talking necessarily about the skin. What is white, no? I mean, today we know from biological sciences and genetic sciences that there is no such thing as a race when you talk about humans. There is the human race, and beyond that, yeah, of course, there are phenotypes, no? There are different colors of skin, but I mean nothing that is genetically relevant, as far as we know, no? And that is the basis of humanism. Yeah, all the cultures are different, but at the bottom, in the essence of what makes us human, we're all the same. Now, this is a discourse. This humanist discourse has been preserved today very much by the people that have spoken, by the intellectuals of the post-colonial movements, of the people that represent those who, by the color of their skin, or by the by what their features mean in the representations of European hegemony, have always been oppressed and suppressed. No? So black writers, black philosophers, brown and black writers and philosophers from all around the world. No? And what they have, I don't know if you listen to James Baldwin or Malcolm X, for example, they always talked about whiteness as an aspiration of how you should dress, how you should talk, how you should raise your children, no?
It's
how
a
you?
Culture.
Yes, and this culture is not only a matter of your behavior, this is also a matter of where you learn your behavior. There are entire systems of thought,
No,
entire libraries dedicated to the study of Dutch history, no? The study of Western thought, no? The study of, efficient and entrepreneurial management, efficient planning, no? Of cities, beautiful architecture. So what is the best of the best in every single field of human production, both material and intellectual? This is, of course, related to the centers of power. Who creates these enormous systems of knowledge that we learn through university, through political propaganda, no, that determine the spatial way in which we live, in which we dress, no, that determine emotions like pride, that you feel pride because you look like something, or you feel shame because you look like something. No? And so who determine this is, for the most part, countries in which the majority of the population are white. This is what whiteness means, no? It is an idea of what is the good life, what are the good morals. No? And it is a difference that is necessarily constructed in the reflection of the colonized.
Right.
So the colonized represent, no, what the Europeans are not. And it is by comparison to them that the Europeans learn to recognize them. This is something that you see in cartography. The more power they acquire, the more arrogant the representations get. And then you have every continent represented with a woman. The woman that represents Europe is always clean and beautiful, blonde, white, no, feminine, voluptuous and attractive. The dresses seem expensive. The cut of the dresses, the design of the dresses, matches with which at the time of the creation of this map was considered the highest, most expensive, most elegant and desirable fashion. No, she has a crown, she has a scepter, which in the tradition of European iconography represents the power of the state.
Right.
She also has a Bible, which means the power of the church. So you have both, you have the power terrenal matters with the represented with the scepter, and the power of religious and spiritual matters represented with the Bible. You also see pheasants, no? Exotic animals related both as a symbol of royalty and as an expensive food eaten only by the aristocracy and the nobility. You also see musical instruments, you see harps, flutes, violins, no? Associated with a refinement, a cultural refinement of high culture. You see enormous bounded books, no? Which today mean nothing, but back then were expensive artifacts. Not everybody had a book. No, having a book of mathematics, if you read it, allowed you to claim you were a mathematician. Having a book of engineering allowed you to claim you had studied engineering. It was not like today. These were important artifacts for knowledge, to claim knowledge and power. In comparison to Europe, you see Africa, for example. That is usually a naked woman without any artifacts representing any culture, any refinement, any sophistication. There are lions or cheetahs or tigers. There is this exoticism, no? But for the rest, yeah, for the rest, it is a naked woman.
You're getting close to, for instance, Edward Said's idea of Orientalism, right?
Yeah. So, and Edward Said is very interesting because Edward Said is a precisely, no? He talks about how the representations of the Arab Muslim world are what Europeans, and particularly not the people, no, not the populations even, but the state itself, the European states have taken as the basis to shape and reshape the Arab Muslim world, particularly through violence. And what he says is, I think you could put his argument very roughly, no? What they have made is a caricature of us, no? Of the Muslims. They create a caricature of the Muslims. But it is important to understand it is not a caricature that is made entirely out of predatory desires. It's also a caricature that is made by serious scholars. People who really want to understand this world and who are fascinated by Arabic as a language, Persian as a language, the mosques of Cairo and the architecture of Baghdad and Damascus. No? Well-intentioned people have created a caricature. And they have created a caricature because they have been allowed to be academics, to be scientists, to be politicians, to be surveyors, cartographers, within a system that profits from oppressing precisely these people. So it is acceptable to create these caricatures. And not only is it acceptable, it is promoted to create a human representation, a humanized, a more accurate representation would be less tolerable than to create a caricature, because the caricature, the offense is entirely besides the point. The point is not to offend, the point is to dominate. The point is to establish the naturality with which you are superior, no?
Right.
And not only that, but also the mission civilisatrice, no? The civilizing mission. You are not a barbarian as a European, no? That's the way they look at each other, at themselves. And this is very interesting psychologically, because you see that they are aware of the problem of the colonization. When they colonize the Americas, they justify it as a matter of evangelization. We are going not there to exploit and enslave the Indians and capture their territories and exploit the resources and enrich ourselves. We are going there to expand the word of Christ and the dominion of Christ, no? The same when they go to the Middle East, and when they have, then they develop a more secular version of the same ideology. We go there because they are inferior. They can use us. We are more modern, we are more advanced, we know better, no? We are taking this burden upon our shoulders, no? This is what, I think it was Kipling that called it the white man's burden. And it was a serious matter. They really believed this, no? We are going into these colonial and imperial enterprises because, no, we are good, no? And this ideology, of course, is ridiculous for the people that actually hold power. I think they are very aware that this is just a way of twisting the representation of a certain portion of the world to convince other people that they are not rapists, that they are not criminals, that they are not plunderers, and that they are not despicable people, but that they are good people. That when they go to the Congo, like the Belgians did, and massacre entire populations to exploit some robber, no? Diamonds or whatever other minerals, trees or precious woods the Belgians exploited, when they go there and chop off the hands, the noses, the lips and the legs of all the black people that they rule over because they don't bring enough of the resources that they ask them to bring, that they don't do it because they are psychopathic criminals, but because they are better. And these black people need to civilize themselves. They need to learn. No? So in a way, it is a very interesting process, no? A very interesting psychological process for entire populations.
Right.
What happens to the populations in Europe is, no? And this is something, for example, that the black poet James Baldwin always said, is in a way much worse than what happens to the enslaved. Because the enslaved, they get dehumanized against their will. They get their bodies, in their bodies themselves, no? in their own bodies, they get mutilated.
Yeah.
No? The suffering is unimaginable for most of them, and it remains so. These traditions of violence, you see them, no? You see them well and alive in Africa today, in the parts that were dominated by the Belgians, no? Like the Democratic Republic of Congo. But what people like James Baldwin also said is, what happens to the white people that does that is perhaps even worse. Because it doesn't happen to one individual, it happens to everybody.
Yeah.
It's entire societies that learn the naturalization, that learn how to naturalize the dehumanization of people that are their own children in many cases. This happens in the south of the US.
Yeah.
You have the white slave owner raping many of the black women that he buys, because this is not just simply one of the natural abuses that happened among all enslaved populations. But then you have the contradiction when the baby is born, no? You have the white baby, or the whiter baby, and the black, or the blacker baby. And depending on the specific criterion of the plantation owner back then, no? That baby is white or black. If the baby is white, he or she get to live in the house and raised as part of the lord's, no? The plantation owner's family. They get to be racist, powerful, no? Aristocrats with comfortable, easy lives. But if they are too black to the criterion of the community or of the person, then they are slaves.
Right.
These are their own children, no? Their own children, of their own children, these people learn to make this to what I think for most of the rest of the world that is not part of this system of white supremacy, what would be a monstrous choice. Huh? Can I profit from my own child? Then I will enslave them and submit them to every single savagery that I know slaves in my plantation are the victims of. Or will I let them live in the house and have a nice life?
Maybe this thought is not that much accessible to the person in a conscious manner as well, right? So maybe the person doesn't think, oh, I can profit from this child, so I put it as a slave. So maybe it's just the system of the entire culture that came with whiteness at that time that made actually this decision to somehow unaccessible to his conscious thoughts, right?
Yeah, this is crucial, no? And this is, I think, something that people today don't understand, both on many sides of the ideological spectrum, and this is a point that, if clarified, I think would make much of the debate on racism much easier.
Indeed.
Because indeed, it's like it is not a matter of conscious racism, no? What we are, I think, especially with the kind of thing we are concerned today, no?
Right.
What concerns the people that try to oppose and to deconstruct and to eradicate racism today is really institutional and systemic racism.
Right.
That is very different than individual racism, no?
Indeed.
And this is proven, for example, in political science, the people that hold really racist convictions, the people that get their blood boiling if they see somebody black or somebody browner, they're not that many, no? The ones that are convinced about the supremacy of the Aryan race or the white race, no? There are a few. It's a marginal group in terms of any demographics, even among the demographics that are voting for white supremacist parties like the Netherlands. These people are not racist in that sense. They are not the racists with a whip that would, no, castigate any black body at the very sight of it. No? It is institutional and systemic racism. It is it is sophisticated in the sense that it turns people that might believe even themselves to be not racist at all, no, to behave in very racist ways. And you see this and this is a matter of expectations. They see, for example, somebody that looks like what they associate with a Muslim in the Netherlands or with a Middle Eastern in the Netherlands, and they feel a little bit nervous because they have learned as a matter of representation in the textbooks that they got in school, in the entire system of representations that has gone through television, entertainment programs, news, talk shows, all sorts of entertainment that they see through not only traditional but also social media. They have learned the prejudices that are traditional to these geographies, which is the Muslims are threatening. This idea of the Muslim as a threatening person, the Muslim, the Arab, the Oriental, no, the Oriental Arab, Persian, Arabic, Moor, as a threatening figure, the ones that rape our women, the ones that plunder our wealth, the ones that want to impose their religion upon us. This goes as far back as the Crusades, maybe even farther back, no? This goes to the very beginning of the emergence of Christianity and Islam, for example, no?
So, we looked at the matter from the angle of the accused, right? Maybe the mm-hmm. white European who is accused as the racist, mm-hmm. right? And we looked at the situation, what could be the root causes of of this way of understanding the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why a white person has been provided, like how a white person has been provided with all this representation, and that forms his understanding of the world, right?
Yeah.
But it would be interesting to also look from the eyes of the oppressed, how he accepts this, right? And you made actually a really interesting point, saying that for the slaves it was a bit different because they could feel it with the bones and the skin that they are being crueled upon,
yeah.
right? However, when you look at, for instance, the colonies, there is a different dynamics also working there. For instance, in Middle East, they have this notion, this discourse of Westoxification, right? Mm. That some group of people have been, let's say, dissolved in West, have been so much maybe suppressed, maybe in love, that they see Europeans and they feel Europeans as superior. So whatever comes from West, whether it's being the way of ruling, whether it's being the music, whether it's being how you dress, whether it's being the language, whether it's being what cosmetics do you use, how do you dance, how do you behave in society, right? They see that as the superior way, and they see the growth or the ultimate of their society to be as similar as possible to what West has.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, so how do you think about that?
I think that that is something that in, for example...
And basically, yeah. how does this interaction forms the dynamics between the two groups?
Right? Yeah. Well, but I think it entirely determines them. This has been both studied and conceptualized by a very interesting writer called Aníbal Quijano. Aníbal Quijano is a Peruvian philosopher, no, that has been concerned with coloniality of power, a concept that he calls coloniality of power. And it is precisely, I think it matches what in the civil rights movement in the United States is considered to be whiteness, no? Whiteness as a way of thinking, what I told you, James Baldwin, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King constantly talked about. No, this idea not of, no, thinking and acting not because you're white, but because also you want to be white. And this is, so this coloniality of power, you see it, of course, I think this determines all the relations. You see it today. It is for people that come from colonial countries to study, for example, or to live in Europe. For many of them, especially, I've noticed, because I'm in this particular field, the ones that get acquainted with post-colonial and the colonial theory, a great source of anguish, their label that is associated to their nationality and their civilization and their identity. For example, I have a very good friend that was very afraid of saying he was Turk when he came to the Netherlands because he felt ashamed, because he assumed everything that was being Turk, everything that meant being Turk was simply inferior. No? Beginning by the race, by the way you look. No? And this is something entirely embedded in a system of colonialist thought science representation that is not confined to the boundaries of European countries and the European continent, but that is also very much promoted in the colonies. This is something that in Mexico we know very well. In Mexico we even say that when somebody acquires money or power, they try to whiten themselves by acting white, by acting more like what the white elites in Mexico and in Latin America act like, by eating European foods, by trying to buy European cuisines, which is interesting in the case of Mexico, because Mexico is a fantastic, no, one of the richest cuisines in the world. And yet, when people acquire more wealth, they start to eat more Italian, more French, more Spanish. They start to buy imported products. It has a lot to do with trade, no? And this is crucial. Whiteness has to do with wealth, with globalized wealth, which very much comes from trade. From moving one thing from one place to another and telling the people in the other place, you really need this. It has to do with advertising and marketing. So that is the thing about whiteness and racism. You cannot deconstruct it by focusing purely on the color of the skin. This is very superficial. You need to focus on the reverberations that whiteness exerts on marketing, on advertising, on trade, on the very representation that we are used to see on Airport Magazine, on all of our advertisements, on the political propaganda, on the representations that children at school get from what the Mexicans look like, what the Africans look like, which still coincide with their racist representations, for example. Now, this is crucial because the world is enormously vast, and we cannot know, not even the most seasoned traveler can by any means know every single part, every single people, culture of the world. And even if they could, they could not understand all of them. They cannot underspeak. They cannot speak all the languages. They cannot understand all the cultural nuances. So what we know, what all of us knows about the world is very much, for a great part of it, based on representations that we have seen in a collection of items, movies, films, books, narratives, propaganda, our families, our friends, which is also determined, of course, by the neighborhood in which we live, the socioeconomic status that is associated with that neighborhood, for example, the possibilities that we have to go to certain schools and to socialize within certain places, you know, certain malls, certain cinemas, certain theaters, certain artistic communities, the languages we speak. An immigrant growing up in the Netherlands, you know, whose parents speak only Arabic, will miss a great deal of Dutch culture that his peers are learning while they're his same age. And this difference will be expressed in primary school to his disadvantage.
Yeah. Huh? Right. So this actually brings us to a very good point, right? Mm. That what would be the solution? Because it's very simplified way of thinking to just decrease the problem to the color of skin, right?
Yeah.
As you mentioned, it's the entire system of culture, of ideologies, of inheritance, right? That a person is brought to. It's the entire ecosystem of marketing, of the economy that works in favor of one group and advertises or promotes one group versus the other, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that's not necessarily aimed at suppressing one skin color versus the other, but the outcome is what's happening today, right?
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. That is a difficult question, how to solve it or how to start solving it.
Because this was an angle.
I think the problem with this is it really depends who you are, no? Mm. I can, for example, I am the victim of racism sometimes, or what I think in any case is racism, but I'm by far not the victim of the same kind of racism than a black African refugee is in the Netherlands. Well, I can deal with it in a very different way, in a much more successful way than they can. Well, I am much better off than most Arabs and Muslim immigrants here, because Mexicans are associated with a lot of violence that is for the most part contained or confined to the country, and for the rest it is, I think, a national stereotype that is very caricaturesque and very friendly is tequila, sombreros, party, and piñatas. Things like this. People do not see me as a threat necessarily. No? But I notice in my Muslim and my Arabic friends, no, they notice this. When they go talk to a girl, they assume, no, there are some sort of players and womanizers that see them, that are going to treat them disrespectfully, and they're very surprised that they don't do it, no?
Right.
When I see No, my Syrian friends, no, going to clubs. You see all sorts of shady white Dutch guys going in like they are the children of the bouncers. And you see, I don't know, any given Syrian guy, regardless of how poor or wealthy he looks, getting checked twice or three times, no? So I think it really depends on the resources that you have. The skin that you have also matters. I can hide a little bit, no? A black person cannot hide, even if they were born in the Netherlands, and even if they speak flawless Dutch, they will be the target of enormous, consistent, sustained, lifelong racism. No? And they know this. And they are very aware about how they look and how people perceive them all the time. They are very aware. And I think that here is the solution. No? I think the solution is in being more aware of the experiences of people that have been traditionally discriminated and traditionally oppressed. Because you find, not that there is something essentially better in them, but there is certainly something they know that we don't know. If you read black writers, for me at least, it has come as a great revelation to be aware of the sophistication of the perception that they have about how others perceive them. They are playing a perceptual game of chess that is much more complicated than many other people because they are forced into it. Black people living not only in white populations, but particularly black people living in America, that has arguably one of the most violent and abusive and corrosive racist systems in Europe and in the US, no? What we call the West, no? That is also a category that I oppose. I think opposing these essentializing categories is very much where the solution lies. Mm. None of these exists essentially. There is a humanity. There is a global history, which is a point stressed over and over by historians. There is no such thing as a Dutch or a French or a Spanish history. These are constructions for the benefit of power in every state. But as a matter of scientific integrity, you can never speak about a Dutch history, about Dutch style of painting, about an Italian architecture, because the beauty of culture is that it is ceaselessly appropriated and reappropriated, and the moment you show something to somebody else, they might copy it, improve it, change it, or modify it. But if they like it in any way, they will take it. And even if they don't like it, they might reproduce it.
Yeah.
And then it's not yours anymore, then it's theirs. But at the same time, it's from everybody's. Huh? And I think the solution, much of the solution lies in finding, being aware of how people perceive us, no? Being aware of how people perceive not only the good things we do, but also the bad things we might do. Which is, I think, something that black writers are, not even writers, black writers that are concerned with issues of race, like James Baldwin, for example, but also writers that write about any other kind of thing, no? They are very aware their characters are black. And you see how they play this chess of perception all the time, when they flirt, when they go for a job interview, when they are a waiter in a restaurant and they serve somebody, no? When they're walking down the street late at night and they see a white person terrified coming at them, no?
Yeah.
All these things. And this is something that I think black people in the south of the US or black people in many European countries share with women, for example. There is an excellent theory of how women have been taught throughout history to survey themselves, because very much as many other oppressed minorities, so the women are not a minority, no? Many other oppressed minorities or many other oppressed groups of society, they have learned to survey themselves for the pleasure of men so that they are pleasurable to men. And that's why women are very aware of how they look, how they smell, how their hair is arranged, how they behave in certain contexts, what is the proper way to do certain things. Because they're very aware that the perception that men have of them has a great impact on their fate in every single social setting. The same, but much, I think, to a much more heightened degree for black slaves or black people in the US. No? You cannot hide. You can never hide. No, your race, when you're of a different color, of different features within a society that is remarkably, visually, very strikingly different, makes it impossible for you to hide. And if this way in which you look is associated to bad, threatening, evil, undesirable traits, you are in a position of enormous disadvantage.
Yes.
This is a position of enormous disadvantage that you notice very easily when you live in a mostly white northern country like the Netherlands, people don't have at all. They can say all sorts of things that are denigrating and demeaning and vulgar and ordinary in what they consider to be very unthreatening ways. They want to play, they want to make a joke, no? But they can say the most racist things, if you will, about Muslims, about Arabs, about Latin Americans, about Asians, about Africans, black people, anybody. And you see these people take it and smile or smirk because they don't want a confrontation and because they have heard it too many times, they are used to this. Many of them, they even know what to reply because many of these racial slurs are very common. So they are used to it, no? And their skin is very thick already. They know. But then you see what happens when you criticize their culture. You say something about Dutch food, no? You say something about the Dutch anthem. Say something about Dutch morality, no? Go deep and say something about Dutch history and their heroes, no? And their slavery. Make jokes about it. And they lose their minds, many of them, no? Many of them feel their pride touched for the first time and they cannot deal with it, no? And this is what you see in all these alt-right or neo-fascist parties, which are nothing but the same fascist as always. And that's what you see in the kind of heroes, the kind of history, which is essential for any form of political identity. You see that in this history, they try to defend the slave traders, the colonizers, because without any nuance, with their racism, with their imperial and slave-related enterprises, because they cannot deal with the complexity that the people that are used to exploitation and denigration are already used to. They are already used to deal with the complexity because they have been forced, they have been thrown into a corner and given all this massive amount of abuse and at the same time a gift, no? The gift of reflecting on themselves endlessly. And they are very aware that there is much wrong and much right with them and their history and their ancestors and their culture, which is something that I think is something that goes entirely missing for many people in white countries whose national history is related to exploitation, slavery, and colonialism. They are not used to a black person making fun of them, telling them, you might be funny too.
Right.
You might be less too. Your food is actually terrible. No, your morality is disastrous.
Right.
You're not as good as you think you are. Huh? And I think it is, in a way, I think the solution is lies much in this, in people in these countries developing a thicker skin, while the people on the other side that are the ones that could force them to develop a thicker skin also are very wary to criticize while not taking the pride out of them. You cannot take the pride out of any kind of people without them reacting in some way. You cannot say, and that is something, for example, about the left that I don't like, when they say all white people are bad, no? I mean, this is a caricature, no? But when they make a statement that gives you the impression that the meaning is that all white people do this bad thing, no? I think this is very, as a matter of rhetoric and as a matter of history and genetics, no, very poor. You also have to give them pride. It is necessary to say, okay, the history, that is also not history, it's the national history, the one that you have been taught by the people in power in your country, no? This history is wrong, no? But there is pride, no? There is certainly pride in many things, no? That people that look like you and that people that you think that you come from have done. But it's certainly not slavery, and it's certainly not the West Indian companies, none of them. It's not the military adventures that have been oriented towards the exploitation of entire nations and the enslavement of their children. It's other things, no?
Yeah.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, so it's in this case, then, this is a very, very progressive movement that we have these days with the Black Lives Matter, for instance, that is happening not only in the United States, but across the other European countries as well.
Yeah.
So it could actually contribute to the discourse that you are explaining here.
I think so. I don't know. I never expected it. What is happening in the Netherlands now is very unique. I've never seen it. I've been here 10 years, which is not that long. But I never expected to see it. The Netherlands has, for example, a sense of humor that is, I find it very similar to the sense of humor that you can find among the Ku Klux Klan members in the US. Sometimes, not always. No, they also have a very refined humor, but there is a certain kind of popular humor that is very distressing to hear. Because they make jokes about the very, very vulgar jokes about the very physical way in which people that are not white look. No, jokes that involve rape or torture or killing, Nazi jokes,
really, Ku Klux Klan jokes.
And when you hear that, you think, no. And yet, unlike the US, the Dutch do not consider themselves racist, but post-racist, they are above that. And I think many of them think precisely because we are above that, we can be racist because God knows we are not at heart. No? But what is happening now is that you see for the first time that in every single newspaper in the Netherlands, the dike that used to contain that kind of reflection about their own racism has broken. And the newspapers and society has been flooded with narratives and history and reflections and remarks, articles everywhere about police brutality against minorities, and especially against black, brown, Muslim minorities. You see all the Dutch people with an immigration background that comes from one of the former colonized countries, Suriname, Curaçao, Indonesia, speaking out, talking about how, in spite of them being Dutch, they have been systematically discriminated all their lives, and how this matters. For the first time, you hear an enormous amount of white Dutch people making reflections about their white privilege. In a way, this is a discourse imported from America.
Sure.
No? And in that sense, it should be contextualized, because I don't think the Netherlands has the same problems that the US, of course. But in no way does the Netherlands have let... No? In no way is the Netherlands ridden... Has the Netherlands gotten ridden of its racism or of its white supremacy? So much not so that today the only European country with an openly white supremacist party that might win a substantive power, if not the prime ministership in the next elections, is a white supremacist party of an ideology that, to my knowledge, is very novel in the European continent. It is not the classical neo-Nazi fascist playing party. It is a white supremacist party that reproduces the strategies, the representational, the discursive strategies of the South racists of the US, and in that way it is imported, but in another way it's not, because of course the racism in the US in the end came from Europe.
Thank you very much. Is there anything else you would like to add to the discussion we had today that you think we left untouched?
I don't know. Well, there is much I think we left untouched. But I think what we touched was good enough, I think, for start.
Okay.
To start a little reflection, perhaps.
Oh, thank you very much, Rodrigo. It was a pleasure to have you.
It was my pleasure.
Thanks.